author of Green Knight, Black Knight, an examination of British Columbia's energy sector, Randon Seibold in the first half. And in the second half, author, journalist, activist, and educator George Monbiot discusses his new book, Captive State, The Corporate Takeover of Britain. George Monbiot in the second half. And sadly, for Janine fans, Janine is not going to make the scene today, but you can catch her own show, Thursday's Winds of Change at 11 a.m. right here at CFUV. So first up, Randon Seibold and taking a look at British Columbia's jousting energy nights. Stick around. Well, welcome to the program, Randon.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's my great pleasure, of course. And now, Randon, we in British Columbia, we're quite used to our cheap electricity, and we think, you know, hey, everything's good with us. I mean, we're not worried. But how would you characterize BC's current energy position vis-a-vis the rest of the world?
Well, it's pretty enviable. We are pretty blessed, and you know, it's been called the Saudi Arabia of green energy, meaning we've got everything from micro hydro to, you know, big hydro dams to wind resources to geothermal to tidal. It's all here, so it really does have the potential to be a green power powerhouse, if you will.
Well, now, we've heard this now, but I mean, we're sort of like maybe Saudi Arabia in the 19th century, where we have this latent possibility, but we don't seem to have a whole lot coming off the ground here, especially not compared to places like Europe.
Yeah, for sure. We are definitely, you know, near the back of the pack in a sense, because of the fact that we are so spoiled. And it's the large hydro dams that we've had, of course, are paid for now by past generations mostly. And they've basically reached their capacity for what they can provide, especially when the people in power in BC are looking at our potential as an exporter, a huge electricity exporter for North America. And this is where we're at right now. Is there's a sense, a real shift happening, and there's basically a serious hijacking going on. And this is probably the biggest bit of news I wanted to try and convey tonight, is that if we were to use a metaphor here, green knights, black knights, and pirate ships, we are the merchant ship, and this is a nighttime takeover happening right now, grappling hooks on both sides, boarding, and we're really in trouble in that sense as far as privatization goes, free trade agreements with Alberta that have recently come to light, and applications from the U.S. Electricity Utility Regulatory Board. And it's just, we're totally under siege here, but most people still aren't very aware of that. But we will be shortly.
Yeah, well, this is it. I mean, electricity, I mean, it really is. I mean, the old conservation ads, you say, well, it's not something that just comes out of the wall, but largely it is something that just comes out of the wall. It's ubiquitous. We're used to it. We rarely get blackouts here in British Columbia, but there is a lot more going on behind this. And BC Hydro, now this, as you mentioned, this is under threat right now. It's our own government, the British Columbia Liberal government, that is putting this treasure, this gem of the people, in the front of the shop window and leaving the doors unlocked.
Yeah, well, they're taking care of their own in a sense, and it's only the gem of the people if the people feel it is their gem to protect and what, you know, hold up for future generations. And I mean, it's a huge source of revenue for everything from roads to hospitals, you know, you name it, that is just about to just go up in smoke, basically. And also the electricity rates are going to rise correspondingly as well. So we're about to pay high, even though we're blessed with such an abundance of electricity. Now, the one way that a person could, of course, get around that is look at, as opposed to investing in new vehicles, invest in your own electricity systems. Mm-hmm. And I think that is something that is going to become increasingly common as both a necessity and as a status symbol. And it will really allow one to step out of that cycle of dependence with the utility.
Well, this sort of gets into your other endeavor, as well as writing the book, Green Knight, Black Knight, but is turbine marketing and going into these alternative fields of power production. How easy would it be for you know, Joe and Jane Blow to actually go up there and make themselves, you know, take themselves off the grid and make themselves the grid themselves, you know?
Well, I mean, it's not that difficult if you're willing to invest in it. I mean, it is your electricity. You know, people say, oh, that's so expensive. But when you look at it, you cannot run anything without it unless you are still versed in the old ways.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a good investment, really.
Oh, with all the electrical gadgets and a new one born every other minute, it seems, you know. I mean,
yeah.
we're so dependent. All you need is a blackout, really, to sit down and remember just, you know,
take you right back to the old days and the old ways.
Well,
I mean,
really,
right, you can go to Canadian Tire these days and pick up a great package of you know, a generating source and all the circuitry required and a battery backup system and all the whole nine yards for, you know, under $10,000, basically. Now, Jane and John do have to invest, you know, roughly $15,000 to $20,000 for a decent kit that will cover, you know, 50% of their needs, say, in the case of.
And what is this, solar and maybe micro hydro and conservation devices?
It's very place dependent what kind of power you can use, whether it's micro hydro or if you're in a windy area, if you are in the Peace River region or in the north of the island, for example, or in Squamish, you know, you're going to have wind you can take advantage of.
Mm-hmm.
But you just mentioned conservation, and that's a big one that everyone should start there, as opposed to buying electricity generating systems first. Convert those loads to lower draw, and then you can actually run an entire household on solar panels fairly well, because you're only drawing half of what you previously were drawing.
Well, and hey, don't use the dryer, maybe, you know. I want you, you know, get a rack and hang your clothes or for at least half the time, you know.
Yeah, that's find ways to time it, you know. And we're just so energy illiterate, like you said, that we don't know. We don't know when to run it and when not to run it. The whole idea of peak power usage is really a big one too. That's why PC Hydro needs to generate more power.
Oh, sure. You can see it. People get home from work, and what do? You know, they turn on all the lights, they turn on the TV, they turn on the computer, and then you start working on, you know, making supper. Maybe there's a dishwasher afterwards, you know, and it all starts happening at once.
Yeah, so if we can shift that peak a little bit, that does take away some of the steam from their argument that we need to build more generation. We need, you know, we need coal-fired power plants in BC for, you know, first time in recent memory. So that's the big one right now. So as far as what's happening in BC right now in the energy scene, there was a call for power announced. The winners were announced back in the summertime. You might remember that. And I thought I might read here and there out of this product that I've come up with, the book. And and for example, for the summer of 2006, sort of quickly covering just what's happening.
Well, it is important for our listeners to remember. I mean, there's been a lot going on recently, and they can be forgiven. I mean, in the local electricity and power and energy markets in British Columbia, especially on Vancouver Island.
It's hard to keep track of, yeah.
I mean, there is a lot going on. Now, you mentioned the coal bed. Now, the very controversial development of what they call coal bed methane, which is something that's not very well tried. It's something bordering on experimental. But the social costs, maybe you can go over a little bit of what this means in the interior of British Columbia to some of the First Nations bands. I'm thinking of the Yatlan. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Oh, well, I read something about a lake there that was going to basically be completely filled, and that was due to mining, not so much coal bed methane. But I know that coal bed methane is really water resource intensive.
The Taltan. I'm sorry, the Taltan Nation, and
okay, yeah, right. Well, yeah, actually, I go a little bit into the Taltan story in the book, and basically, there's a number of mega projects descending on that traditional territory, everything from gold mining to coal mining and some hydroelectricity generation. And for the amount of people that actually live there, five new projects is really a daunting prospect. So,
and whereabouts in British Columbia is, where are the Taltan?
The Taltan are in Telegraph Creek area. And Telegraph Creek is almost up to the BC-Alaska border. It's on the Stikine River. and it's real wild, rugged, beautiful country.
Yeah, this Tikkun, isn't that like a World Heritage or something area somewhere around there? World Wildlife Heritage?
Oh, possibly. I mean, purely because of its remoteness. I mean, it really is quite pristine still. But of course, you know, there's loads of raw resource minerals there and whatnot as well. So there's a bit of a leadership struggle that happened there last year, and the Taliban are really trying to just wake up to the fact of what's happening around them, that they cannot just sit and, you know, and be complacent while this goes on.
Well, of course, and these big companies, these big resource companies, they come in with truckloads full of money, and they divide the community and set them against mm-hmm. each other, and this is a classic case of what's happened with the Taliban, isn't it?
Yeah, very much so. But what happened last summer was a group of elders basically felt this was their responsibility to stand up against it, and they proceeded to have a sit-in at the band office that lasted a couple of hundred days, and that forced the chief out, who was elected mostly from off-reserve voters, and basically created a bit of a deadlock there as far as the resource companies were concerned.
So that's
been up in the air a little bit there for sure.
That's Jerry Asp now, and I'd yeah. never heard of this. I mean, I guess it's obvious that there's a lot of First Nations that live off reserve. You know, they live in Vancouver, Victoria, other places where there's more work and so forth and so on. But this guy was clever. He went and he tracked down a lot of these people and then managed to get their franchise, and then came back with a barrel full of votes from people that no longer live in the community and took over.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It was pretty conniving for sure. And when you have the support of government and experienced resource companies, then it's. But you know, the timing at this point in history is also very tricky for them to win too, because the First Nations are really getting activated
mm-hmm.
on a lot of different fronts. You know, there's this whole new demonstration of leadership coming from the young and from the elders as well, and just a sense of, hey, you know, we are not powerless, and it's been pretty dramatic. I mean, the Haida Gwaii are a great example of that, and there's been correspondence, I know, between the Haida and the Tahltan elders as well as to how to, you know, confront the situation.
Okay, well, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria, 104.3 on the cable dial, and heard around the world at cfuv.uvic.ca. I'm speaking tonight with Randon Seibold, and Randon is the author of the book Green Knight, Black Knight, and that's knight with a K, or like on your chessboard there. And basically, this is a rundown of energy of the current, or at least a recent and ongoing developments in the west coast of Canada here, and in a global sense too, Randon?
Yeah, mostly, yeah, it is somewhat touches on global aspects, but mostly it focuses on sort of real-time events in BC and Alberta. And I've had some comments from folks that it does sort of jump around a lot, that it is a little, you know, a little confusing that way, but that partially was to reflect how things unfolded in a chronological way in real time. So you'd have an event take place, you know, say something to do with the Duke Point gas plant,
mm-hmm.
and then other things would happen, and time would pass, and then something would come up with that again. So it does sort of play out like a journal, and you know, people should be aware of that if you're going to go read it.
Well, Vancouver Island really is a foci of the development that's been going on, and it's a perfect laboratory, really, because we've had a bit of everything thrown at us here in the way of proposals. Do you want to run down, firstly, you mentioned Duke Point. What's the Duke Point proposal, and what's the problem with
well,
that?
That was, you know, a 10-year saga in the making, basically. It really went from Port Alberni to Cowichan Valley to, I believe, somewhere else in the east coast of the island, I'm not sure exactly where, but it was rejected in all those locations.
Yeah, North Cowichan, and then they went to South Cowichan, and divide again with this sort of divide and conquer sort of mentality in the community.
Yeah, I think originally it was even scheduled for Port Alberni or for Campbell River, because there was already a plant there, a cogen plant. But in many of these cases, there was no zoning in place. The zoning would have had to be changed to allow for industrial development, and on that it got stopped every time, and then it had no traction.
And this is a natural gas.
In Nanaimo.
This is a natural gas powered energy
natural gas plant.
Right.
Yeah, Yeah, every time. And in Duke Point, in Nanaimo, it's already industrial zoning. Mm-hmm. So it's basically, you know, set to go. Yeah, we can build this here. And, you know, initially Nanaimo was receptive to it. City Council was receptive. They saw that the tax base increased. They saw the jobs. And, you know, let's go. But at the same time, there was a lot of people against it. You know, a lot of folks on Gabriola.
Yeah, Gabriola especially.
And Nanaimo, yeah, Gabriola is really against it because that was right in their air path. Basically.
Well, yeah, if nobody's, you know, been to Gabriel Island, it's you know, it's like a 15-20 minute ferry ride out of Nanaimo Harbor. And what you get if you live on the west side of Gabriel Island, you're treated to a view of a pulp mill, which is going and smelling up the place. And this is where they, you know, right beside this, or right in conjunction with this, where they were going to build this huge natural gas powered electricity generating system with no care for what the airshed, what kind of effects this might have, mixing these different effluents together in the airshed.
No, exactly. It was, you know, just natural gas is clean. You know, what's the problem?
Yeah, well, I like one of your acronyms, BIG, for the sort of mentality, and this is BHIG. Do you want to explain what that means?
Oh, BHIG or BIG is burns hot is good. You know, it's a real simple mentality, and I believe it's an early throwback to ancestral man, where fire was amazing. You could be relied on, you know, and that's, it hasn't left us. If it's burning hot, it's reliable, it'll make power, and damn it, let's burn it.
Well, and the idea too, though, is that most of the nasty stuff is burned up, you know, and so you're not, it doesn't come out as pollution necessarily. You're smoldering crap and so forth.
If you compare natural gas to coal, of course, it is very clean, a clean burning, you know, fuel source, but it's still a ton of carbon dioxide, and we're not really talking about particulate. That's not our big concern these days. We've moved beyond that. We've completely, you know, superheated the atmosphere, so climate change is definitely being driven by carbon dioxide. There is no scientific debate about that. And to install a natural gas-fired power plant, which emits like 700,000 tons per year of carbon dioxide, that's really, you know, a step backwards. So when I heard about this, one of the biggest concerns for me, being, you know, entrepreneurial and looking at, you know, the opportunities of green energy to be both a source of a career as well as a way to really have a relevant impact on protecting the environment, was this is really going to shrink the need for things like wind power on the north end of the island, or tidal energy, or any of these sort of opportunities. So, I really felt like, okay, you know, people need to be kind of get informed a little bit about what's going on as far as this sort of contest between dirty energy and clean energy.
Yeah, well,
and how to support your tournament, your night, you know.
Well, and again, Vancouver Island, I mean, this is the arena. I mean, because now you mentioned wind and tidal. Well, now there's been an announcement that there's a big project, I think 700 and some odd million dollar project proposed for the north tip of the island up around Holgren, I believe it is, right?
Let's see. Well, the north end of the island, nothing new is really happening there. That $700 million announcement is for actually the Haida Gwaii area. That's the Nikkun wind project.
Oh, I thought that was Holberg. 150 wind turbines outside of Holberg.
Yeah, that was the Seabreeze proposal from a few years ago.
Okay.
There may be another one, but I certainly haven't heard of it yet, and I've got a pretty steady stream of information. but there was three wind programs a couple of years ago. One was the Holberg proposal, which was for 50 megawatts. And another one was for the Seabreeze project on Knob Hill, which was for roughly 150. And then the third was this 300 to 700, like a huge number of megawatts project in Haida Gwaii, in the offshore there.
Well, now really, Randon, is it worthwhile to generate that kind of electricity in such a remote area? I mean, aren't you going to lose a great...
Potentially not. That's, you lose a lot of voltage if you have to transmit it.
That's a long way to carry it.
Yeah, it is. And it makes a lot more sense with renewable energy and energy in general is to generate it close to where you will use it.
Locally and on a smaller scale, more of a holistic approach rather than this big daddy server idea that we've been so used to. Well,
when you go through Europe, you often see wind towers, not in huge farms, but in groups of, you know, 1 to 5 turbines and serving that region. That makes a lot of sense.
Well, now, but these proposals for... for Vancouver Island, and now you say Haida Gwaii as well, but these are more on the California model of like a mass number of these things. What what kind of danger does that pose the wildlife up there? Not to mention just the aesthetic look of it, but I mean, the, is this going to be...
I mean, I'm a believer in the fact that they look great, for one. The newer turbines are beautiful, tall, graceful, you know, the pearly white towers, but the ones in California, the Altamont Pass, which is often quoted as an area where there's a lot of raptors killed, because there are a lot of raptors killed there. Mm-hmm. It's a migratory route for raptors, and most of the towers there are the shorter, you know, 100 kilowatt to 1 megawatt size towers, and they have the lattice grid frames, and they make great roosting areas for birds, and the tower and the blades are also whipping around at high speed. The much larger towers, you can replace 10 of those smaller deadly towers with one large one, and you can totally clean up the landscape. You know, you can really reduce the amount of actual individual towers needed, and the blades rotate, even though the tips of the blades are moving very quickly, around 200 kilometers an hour. The size of the blade is so vast that it's a very, generally a slow-moving object that can easily be avoided. I think the amount of actual bird kill statistic per tower in a place that is like an open plain or a ridge is less than, I think it's less than 0.1% or something. It's 0.06 birds per tower.
Well, I did read that there was some concern from biologists at Pincher Creek, Alberta, where there's another wind farm set up, catching the wind coming through the passes in the Rockies there. But it wasn't birds necessarily that they were so worried about, but bats.
Bats seem to be having more problems than birds with the towers, and they're not sure yet why that is. I've actually spoken with a friend, a biologist, who has done a lot of the research on the north end of the island and in the Peace Country for the towers and the effects on birds, migratory patterns, and bats. And yeah, the report is, why are these bats not able to sonar this out? And so that's certainly something that, you know, obviously has to be studied and remediated over time as things are more better understood. But again, the argument comes back to, you know, is it going to be a coal-fired power plant? Is it going to be a wind tower that can be progressively improved? Well, and as far as if, when you compare the you know, air pollution versus wind tower bird kill factor, it's, you know, it's not really much of a contest. Now, none of those projects so far on the island have been approved wind projects, but what has happened recently with this call for power that went out in the summer, it was announced early August, 3 wind projects were actually approved in all in Peace River Country, up near Dawson Creek, Tumbler Ridge and area. It was the Bear Mountain Wind Partnership, Mount Hayes, and Doki Wind Energy. So those are the 3 names that are associated with those projects. And so that, you know, that's great. That's a real move into joining the rest of Canada, which every province has utility scale wind power, for, you know, operating, except for BC. And this would allow us to obviously join with that progressive source of energy. I think we just passed 1,000 megawatts countrywide this spring, and that's according to the Canadian Wind Industry.
Well, and
the association.
But you mentioned too that there's the international body, the World Energy Council. They were casting around the globe and looking at, you know, various potentialities here, there, and the other place, and they landed on British Columbia with a very favorable report indeed.
Yeah, there's 2 main areas that are really steady, consistent wind. That's the north end of the island, and you know, between the island and Haida Gwaii, and the Peace River Country. And both those areas would be prime generating sources for power. So
well, and now, and
it's time to try it out.
Well, and then this Sea Breeze, now you mentioned before, this Sea Breeze Energy Incorporated, they put their proposal forward. They were thinking of a number of ideas, but they're sort of emblematic of what's going on in this industry as a whole.
They are. And in more ways than one, actually, they've basically shifted their focus now to building undersea transmission lines. And they had a bid in to put an undersea cable in from Tsawwassen over to the island, which, you know, BC Utilities Commission has busy been wrangling with the Tsawwassen residents over that one. And their plan, you know, was to be superior in the sense that it was going to be underground and therefore not an electromagnetic hazard and what have you. But their bid was rejected in favor of the BC Hydro or the BC Transmission Corporation bid. However, they're also involved in building another line from Esquimalt over to Port Angeles, and that's something listeners down there are probably somewhat familiar with.
Yeah, I'm curious. I read that with some trepidation. Now, I mean, first of all, Port Angeles is not a very big town. I can't imagine why, you know.
No, it's for California and for Oregon and Washington State. I mean, like
so this is
really,
just
at the beginning of this conversation, we are under siege here. These are the grappling hooks from the pirate ship.
This is just to feed this vast electrical grid that is run by the crooks and criminals that we saw during the Enron scandal in California not so very long ago, right?
Oh, I'm not so sure about that myself. All I know is that we have a lot of energy here in BC and Canada, and we've got to get it down to those 300 million people in the United States. That's sort of the overall plan as far as North America is unfolding right now. Mm-hmm. And the wishes of the people of British Columbia sounds pretty quaint if you look at this in reality terms. It is quaint.
We're looking at billions of dollars, but then if we're selling on that open market in the United States, that means because of NAFTA, we have to charge.
We're not making billions of dollars, but someone is.
Well, someone, yes. Someone is profiting billions of dollars out of British Columbia generated power.
Basically, it comes down to us. How much proprietary ownership do we feel towards, our province, our trade, our resources? It really is up to us to defend those rights. And rights are not rights. I really don't believe that rights actually exist unless you really take them forward. They can be lost, they can be gained. They're more like privileges or advantages, and you snooze, you lose kind of thing. So right now we've been snoozing and we're losing, and this undersea transmission to Port Angeles, I think, is just an example of a corporate independent power producer who has made a bid to generate clean electricity. This is sort of devil's advocate a little bit here, to generate that wind power, and BC Hydro hasn't been interested. And it's like, well, what do you do then? The Northwest states are interested. In fact, many of the states are very progressive in their uptake of renewable power, more so than than BC has been and other provinces. They've got to turn a profit. So let's put this transmission line in, and it'll be a two-way line. So if we ever need power from there, well, we can.
Oh yeah, sure.
All good.
But this is kind of how Vancouver Island's energy odyssey began, with BC Hydro saying, "Well, we've got these two electrical cables that come and feed the island from the mainland, where the power is generated primarily, although not solely, by hydroelectric dams. But they're getting old, and one of them's going to be taken out of commission. So we're going to build the so-called Georgia Strait crossing gas pipeline and mm-hmm. build gas-fired plants so you can generate your own electricity. Where's the GSX idea? Has that completely sunk, or are they still trying that?
No, it's been killed off completely.
Completely dead.
The crossing was killed off. The Duke Point gas plant is killed off. So this is where I'd like to hold up the banner of the Green Knight here and say, for anyone who feels remotely interested in our energy security, as well as possible opportunities as far as being involved in green power, there's a lot to be, thankful and hopeful about, because we've had a pretty good record here recently in holding these activities at bay and forwarding the case for green energy, as well as the climate change situation has definitely not gone away. It's really on the front burner now, and everyone knows about it, even though nobody's still, a lot of people aren't talking about it, but it's the elephant in the room,
case
for the coal power is just getting weaker and weaker. So I don't think those coal plants are going to get built either that have recently been.
But you would know it to listen to the Canadian government, the federal government. I'm thinking of here now, our environment minister, Rona Ambrose, is just freshly returned from the UN Climate Change Conference in Africa.
Hair messed up and a bloody lip and all. I really believe they are obsolete before they even got started. Like that crew, the Rona Ambrose, Harper, Bush, Cheney crew, they're not to be looked at as where things are going. They really aren't. They're going, basically.
Well, Harper represents very well the interests of his Alberta oil patch upbringing and his Texas friends in the United States.
And Alberta is powerful. I mean, there's no question about that. There's going to be a need for crude oil for quite some time, and they'll pump what they can out of those oil sands, but those oil sands won't be able to keep that many people in oil. So it will become increasingly a situation where the Black Knight is fortified in his fortress, and this vast and diverse army of the Green Knight will just be all around the gates, digging under the walls, coming over and through the sky, you know, just relentlessly pursuing these destroyers of our future, basically, in very literal terms.
Well, Randon, now you say one of the reasons you wrote this book, and again, it's Green Knight, Black Knight, and maybe, Randon, you can give the website so people could check out your
sure.
website.
It's www.turbinemarketing.com, and the reason I call it Turbine Marketing, this little firm, was just to evoke a more slightly industrial sense of things, as well the wind turbine kind of inspired the term. So people should think of work and power and energy, and then once you look into it a little deeper, you realize it's very much about, you know, a power of resistance and of revolution, as well as of
so you can say ohm.
You can say ohm. That's right.
It's the power of resistance.
Very literal electrical terms.
The power of resistance into the Green Knight area and start helping us develop alternatives.
Yeah, the competition will become fierce for manpower, and already is, you know, person power. And I really believe that if people are aware of those opportunities that are coming online to work with renewable energy firms, that will be one of the most effective ways to actually reduce our emissions and increase our quota of green power, is to bleed the workforce out of the carbon industry. It's the protests are all well and good, but in Alberta, you know, it certainly hasn't slowed the oil sands down a bit. What has, though, is the high price of labor and the shortage of labor. So I think, you know, that's a major key. And green energy recruiting has a lot to offer the climate change battle to reduce greenhouse gases.
Well, what about this? I mean, are Canadians in danger of seeing our best talent, you know, in this field, just say, oh, we'll get fed up with the slow rate of development in this country and go to California or Germany or Denmark?
Yeah, definitely. People who are interested in those sort of things would, you know, look at Ontario. They're definitely in a situation now where they've basically arrived at that point. They're ready to jump in with California and get serious about solar. So, you know, people who want to get a career in that, they'll go there. And there's schooling, there's diploma courses offered at several Ontario colleges for renewable energy technologists and what have you. And I actually list those schools in this book near the end there. And the training, you know, the opportunities to start having a more tangible effect are there, but, you know, have to seek them out. That's why I've decided to get into this, you know, become an electrician, basically, as opposed to, like, take a sales and marketing program or, you know, human resource management or anything like that. Because having a practical, hands-on perspective on this, I think, is key at this point. We know the problem exists. We know what the opportunities to change and improve are. And, you know, installation and changing out the wiring, so to speak, is really where we're going to be at in the next 5-10 years, so...
Well, and it really is all about electricity. I mean, you know, when it gets right down to it, all of these, you know, the electronic age and everything, nothing happens without electricity. I mean, nothing.
I mean, the mobility thing with vehicles and peak oil and, you know, looking at biofuels to help replace that and hydrogen propulsion and stuff, really the most energy efficient way to go with that is electrical propulsion.
Yeah.
You can fill a battery much more quickly than, you know, a tank. And so, yeah, that's, as far as, you know, we could use thousands of green-orientated electricians for sure right away.
Yeah, well, yeah, and the vehicle emissions, what is it? It's like roughly half of all of the carbon emitted is from personal vehicles.
And we have a lot of responsibility there for sure.
Well, now, you also say, Randon, on your site, now, you pose kind of an interesting question near the end, and I'm not sure that there is an answer to it, per se, but mm-hmm. you say, well, to British Columbians, you say, well, just ask yourself, you know, what do you want your future in British Columbia to look like? What do you want your energy future? What do you want your environmental future? What do you want your lifestyle future to look like? Is it going to be, you know, I'll ad lib this part of it, you know, will it be like, on, you know, Southern Ontario or, you know, What kind of answer do you have for what kind of future you'd like your British Columbia to look like, Sam?
Well, ideally, British Columbia will be, there's a quote at the beginning, actually, I'd like to read, and it comes from the BC Sustainable Energy Association submission to the BC Alternative Energy and Power Technologies Task Force. And just a brief note about the BC Sustainable Energy Association, for those who aren't aware of it. It was basically born right around the time of sort of midway through the Duke Point saga. And it's made up of a diverse group, everyone from people who are in renewable energy firms to just students and advocates and, you know, little old grandmothers. And you know, it's a really a citizen-based movement to get informed, educated, and inspired to make sure that the type of BC that we have is 100% pollution-free, clean power showcase. And so the quote here, one strategic hope: the problems of global climate change are caused by the very same fuels that are about to peak. If we tackle the problems of peak oil and gas, we will simultaneously tackle global warming and vice versa. It all points to the need for BC's cities and regions to design and then develop. So it's up to the cities and the regions primarily. We're not looking to Victoria so much, so it has to come bottom up. Design and develop a future based on sustainable energy. If BC can join other global leaders in this endeavor, instead of being toward the back of the pack, we will be well positioned as a global hub for the multi-trillion dollar sustainable energy revolution. Considering our position geographically and all the different sort of laboratories and classrooms that we have within the geography, the natural landscape of BC, it's a perfect place to enact this. So I'm ready to jump in and take advantage of that. It seems so very doable. I mean, the low electricity rates, hey, that's good. You know, it gives us a chance to be able to play with this stuff and not at a huge cost. So,
and it's true that we're so fortunately placed. I mean, think of it. I mean, it's not like the oil of Arabia under our feet, but we've got the waves of the Pacific that is a perpetual motion machine, you know, coming right to our shore. We do have lots of sunshine, lots of wind as well. And a very a small population, but well educated, and you know, if allowed, if the politics would allow us, we could really get on with the job and do something. I mean, at least as much as they've done in tiny Denmark and other places in Europe. Instead, you know, it's sad to say that, you know, we're spending billions and billions of dollars fighting wars in far off places that are just routes for fossil fuel pipelines, essentially, is what it's all about. And even today, Tony Blair says the whole world depends on what happens in the fields of Afghanistan. Well, he doesn't mean the poppy fields. He means the roots of these pipelines. And these are the last gasps of the dinosaurs. And I'd hate to think they're going to take us all down with them, you know?
So would I. You know, and they're certainly, you know, I'm fully prepared to accept that it'll be pretty painful learning curve in the next 20 years as far as just conflict and the effects of climate change, etc. But that's what happens. Civilization for you, that's humanity for you. You know, we've kind of been down this road before, maybe not on this scale, but...
Well, they're interesting days indeed. Well, we're fast running out of time, Randon, but do you want to throw by the email address one more time for people who want to look more into the work that you guys are getting up to?
Okay, yeah, the website again is turbinemarketing.com, and you can actually go there and find a list of recent renewable energy job postings that have been made in BC, Alberta, Canada, and the Northwest states. So I'm trying to make those available to people so that you can actually contact employers and apply for work. And there's also other resources. There's a film and audio room where there's video and links that you can tune into.
And you don't have to wait. I mean, you know, just like when you're out of the room, turn off the TV, or don't leave three lights on. You know, just be aware that, you know, this stuff that comes out of the wall, it's coming from somewhere.
If you're done with that computer, turn the power bar off. Go ahead, you know, turn the whole thing down.
Yeah, it won't kill you. Yeah, this is a lot of thing with bleed, you know, a lot of this bleeding energy, so-called, I mean, that just gets
phantom,
wasted.
The phantom loads. I was just going to make a quick plug for the book here. I have, I'm just about to release the soft cover. It's been available as an ebook for a while, but I want to release the soft cover in limited runs.
Mm-hmm.
And they will be available for purchase from the website or in some select retailers.
On 100% recycled paper using non-poisonous ink and everything?
Oh, I wish. Yeah, really.
Well, if you wish. Yeah.
That's right. You have to put that forward.
It's possible.
Yeah. It's going to work towards that. I have to put out limited runs, just sort of test the market and, you know, do a trial run, so to speak. And then there's an interest showing, I can continue it on a more expensive level, if you will.
And what is it, New World? New World Publishers or something out of Salt Spring or something?
I'm self-publishing, actually.
Okay.
It's all on my dime here, so I'm just having to learn my way through it as I, you know, also going to work full-time.
Well, I wish you...
Construction industry, so...
Oh, well, you'll be here busy there, too, then, I guess,
yeah.
Judging by what's going on around here. Well, Rand and Seibold, it's all very interesting, and I do hope your book, Green Knight, Black Knight, does well for you.
I will send you a copy, Chris, for your own very good, pleasurable reading instead of having to read off that screen.
Well, that'd be very kind of you indeed. All right, well, thanks a lot for coming on. And as I said before, Janine's not going to make it this week, but I do have a taped interview I did with George Monbiot that's quite interesting, and I'll get as much of that in as I can after the break. Thanks again, Randon.
All right, thank you, Chris. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
And welcome back to Guerrilla Radio, CFUV 101.9 FM, 104.3 on your cable dial, and cfuv.uvic.ca around the world on the internet in Shoutcast. As I said, I talked to George Monbiot. This is kind of an old interview, a couple of years ago, but he's a really interesting guy, and I'm going to get as much of this in as I can, but I did go a little long, so I'm not going to get the part in when he talks about Tony Blair. I guess that's what made me think of it. I read a really outrageous quote from Tony Blair today or yesterday, but he talked about Tony and his wife, whose name escapes me right now, Sherry or something. They were down in Mexico, down in the Yucatan, in the south, by where there's these Mayan ruins and stuff. And they're really into these freaky religions and stuff. And George talks about it in the interview, but we're not going to get to it. But, you know, the effect of it is that, you know, you talk about the leadership of the world and what they've become. And he took it as a sign of the end of empire, when, you know, there's a corruption amongst the ruling class, and then they finally end up going kind of wacky and believing in all kinds of weird, you know, pseudoscience and witchcraft. And this is what Tony and Sherry were doing down there. They'd rub themselves naked on the beach and under the full moon by the ruins of the Mayan ruins, and rub themselves with mashed up fruit and go baying at the moon and jumping in the sea. But as I said, you're not going to get a chance to hear that. But George Monbiot is an interesting guy nonetheless. He's an author, a journalist, activist, educator. The book we're talking about in this interview is Captive State, the Corporate Takeover of Britain. He's a recipient of the United Nations Global 500 Award for Outstanding Environmental Achievement, the Lloyd's National Screenwriting Prize, the Sony Award for Radio Production, One World National Press Award, and on it goes. And that's from a few years ago. I'm sure he's won the Oscar or something since. But here's George Monbiot from a couple of years back. Welcome to the program, George.
Thanks, Chris.
Well, you begin Captive State, rather, with a quote from Abraham Lincoln. It's a cautionary warning about the power of incorporation. What was Honest Abe worried about?
Well, what he saw was that when corporations managed to become political actors as well as economic actors, then they can unleash a power which governments and citizens find extremely difficult to contain. And that is precisely what's happening today. We've got corporations, most of them are based in the rich nations, acting all over the world with an extraordinary degree of freedom. And they've managed to escape from most forms of political control. They've managed to assert the rights of a human being, but without any corresponding legal responsibilities. And the result is that they present a grave threat to democracy and a grave threat to the standard of living which we should expect to enjoy.
Well, now, in my brief intro, I laid all this at the feet of Margaret Thatcher. Am I being unfair in doing that?
Well, she was definitely partly responsible for it, and she certainly took an idea and pushed it further than it had gone before. But she was predated somewhat by by the economists such as Frederick von Hayek, Milton Friedman of the Chicago School, who first really experimented with this in Pinochet's Chile.
Mm-hmm.
And there they used this extremely vicious right-wing government as a vehicle for trying out all these completely crazy ideas, basically involving dropping state provision, dropping the sort of government support for social welfare, and saying corporations will deal with all this, the market will sort everything out, just leave it to the market and all will be absolutely fine. Well, in Chile, and this was absolutely consistent with government policy there, the result was that the poor became very much poorer, and their state of health, their state of education, their state of social welfare fell through the floor. And Thatcher saw this, saw that it had made the rich much richer, saw that it had made the corporations much richer, and thought, we'll have some of that in Britain.
Well, does this, as Milton Friedman might call it, the invisible hand of the market, does it require the iron fist of a right-wing dictatorship to work to its full fruition, or can it work at all?
Well, what you find, wherever market fundamentalism has taken root, there is a great deal of force behind market forces. And and in many cases, people have to be forcibly dispossessed of their dispossessed of their property, dispossessed of their rights, dispossessed of their legal rights, so that the corporations can then expand into the space previously occupied by human beings, previously occupied by communities. And so what you find is this bizarre combination of almost complete deregulation of corporations accompanied by a very draconian re-regulation of human beings. And we see this in Britain today, for example, where we've had endless repressive legislation, Criminal Justice Acts, Security Services Acts, Police Acts, Anti-Terrorism Acts, you name it, all of which are designed quite severely to curtail the civil liberties of people living in this country. At the same time, we've had a huge amount of deregulatory acts and bills and new deregulatory measures, which are designed to let the corporations off the hook, to let the ultra-rich off the hook, and to give them far more freedom of action than before. And the two things have to go together. You cannot have that extreme freedom of action for corporations and for the ultra-rich unless the rest of the population is repressed, because otherwise the population will fight back and will prevent those corporations and will prevent the ultra-rich from seizing the resources which the rest of us need for our survival.
Well, there's a very famous quote, and I'm not really sure. I mean, I've seen this on the internet many times, and so I can't really vouch for its absolute validity. But it's attributed to Mussolini, who says something to the effect that that fascism shouldn't properly be called fascism, but should be called corporatism. Is Mussolini providing the framework for Friedman and the Chicago School?
Well, I've certainly seen that quote around before, and like you, I haven't taken it back to source. But there's no question that within fascism and within Nazism, there was a very strong streak of corporate empowerment, and of course, the idea of state empowerment going alongside that through industrialization. But I think it would be a mistake to say therefore all states which empower corporations are fascist. I think what we're seeing today is something really rather new. It's a form of political organization which hasn't really got a name yet. People have mentioned neoliberalism or market fundamentalism, but it goes beyond that, because we're seeing new forms of imperialism developing, but they aren't like the old forms of imperialism. It's not a question of seizing hold of a region, occupying it, putting your own colonists in. It's more about asserting geopolitical control of the important strategic regions, while at the same time drafting these trade treaties which permit your companies to go in and to exercise very considerable market control. And it's not, I think it would be wrong to call it fascism. It's not fascism. It's something different, which is a hybrid system composed of the sort of pirate economies which we saw developing in Latin America following the Conquista, in South Asia following the introduction of the British East Asia Company there, and a combination of that and the very repressive policing which we saw in, for instance, the British colonies in the first half of the 20th century, and we saw indeed within Britain and Europe to a great extent in the 19th century. And it's a combination of those two things that have been brought together to create pretty well a new political system, and one which hasn't, to my mind, yet been satisfactorily named. And I've been struggling to come up with a decent name for it, but I haven't succeeded yet.
Well, I mean, over the last decade or slightly longer, we've certainly seen what's being described in the American media as a more muscular approach by the United States. And what that's meant is war in the Balkans, a war in the Middle East, and now a war in the Middle East again, both in Afghanistan and Iraq. Are these manifestations of this new economic paradigm?
They're definitely very closely tied in. And I think if we look at the case of Iraq at the moment, that there are two things in particular which the US is seeking to gain that. The first is strategic control of oil supplies. Now, it's not quite the same as saying it wants Iraq's oil. And this is, I think, where people have made a slight mistake, that they've confused strategic control with ownership. What it wants to do is to make sure that in Iraq, as in the rest of the world, it decides who gets the oil, and it makes sure that those who get the oil get it on their terms, on the US, on terms set by the US administration.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at what the US has been doing all around the world just over the past 3 years, you see that it's managed to acquire pretty well monopolistic control over just about every major oil producing region in the world and every major actual or potential oil transport route. And one of the very few major oil producing regions which it hasn't achieved strategic control over is Iraq. Now, a key issue here is China. China is entirely dependent on external sources of oil. It doesn't have its own sources of oil. It's got a huge requirement for oil. And the US has seen that the great weak link in China, and a thing which can retard its economic and potentially political development and retard China's emergence as a threat to US global hegemony, is the fact that it depends on outside sources of oil. And so what it's been doing very rapidly since the war with Afghanistan is to set up bases and military occupation in every single area from which China could draw oil or through which China could transport oil. It's already achieved complete strategic control of the Strait of Hormuz. It's setting up a new base in Djibouti, which will give it complete control of the Bab al-Mandab. It has set up 13 major military bases in Central Asia, which were supposed to be vanguard bases for the Afghan war, but have remained there and grown bigger since the end of the Afghan war, pretty well getting both China and Russia encircled in Central Asia. It is setting up a military base in San Tome to monopolize the West African oil. It's through the North American Energy Agreement, it's pretty well mopped up all the control, at any rate, over oil supplies in both Canada and Mexico. And it seems that its support for the coup in Venezuela was an attempt to mop up the oil supplies there as well. And it's effectively shutting down, it's shutting off the taps for anyone else, or it's getting itself into a position where it can do that if it wishes to do. And in that way, it can contain China's power.
Well, until very recently, Iraq has been completely boxed in. Their oil, other than an acceptable level of black market stuff passing through the north, has been controlled by the Americans. Was it the fear that the sanctions regime
was becoming too odious for the world community, and they were looking at this sanctions being dropped, that the Americans decided they had to go in militarily now, do you feel?
Well, the three principal oil traders with Iraq were China, Russia, and France, which of course has got something to do with their position on the Security Council on the issue of the Iraqi war.
Mm-hmm.
And they were developing quite a cozy relationship, and they had stable supplies coming from Iraq, which fed back into the oil for food program and all the rest of it. Now, what was very interesting was that in 2000, Saddam Hussein said, right, I'm going to cease selling oil in dollars. From now on, I'm going to start selling it in euros.
Mm-hmm.
And this taps into the second major reason why the US was so keen to go into Iraq, in that this became an extremely profitable and extremely sensible arrangement as the value of the euro grew and the value of the dollar fell. And it meant that Saddam Hussein did very well out of it, and that other nations, particularly Iran and Saudi Arabia, began looking at this as a potential model which they could follow. And indeed, recently, a very senior official at OPEC, this is the oil states cartel, had started talking about the need to switch from dollars to euros for selling oil. If that happens, the international position of the dollar comes under very serious attack. The dollar is massively artificially buoyed from the fact that it's the dominant international currency in which oil is bought and in which other countries maintain their currency reserves to fend off attacks by financial speculators. Now, if the dollar loses its preeminent international position, then the value falls very considerably, and the vast US deficit and the vast US debt become completely unsustainable, and the US economy collapses. It should have collapsed ages ago. It's only because of the international position of the dollar that it's been able to sustain itself. Now, by going into Iraq, they're hoping to, first of all, break the arrangement that Saddam Hussein set up, whereby his oil is bought in dollars, but secondly, to achieve regional control such that no other nation in the region will be tempted to follow his lead and switch from dollars to euros. And so we see a nexus of two things going on here. First of all, Iraq was a supplier of oil to China and to a lesser extent to Russia. Russia's not quite so important in this equation, but China's critical. Secondly, it was setting what the Americans felt was a very bad example by selling oil in euros. And the combination of those two things meant that it was a key strategic imperative if the US was to maintain its global domination to get in there and overthrow Saddam Hussein's regime.
Well, if you've just joined us, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio on CFUV.
Well, if you've just joined us, you're listening to a tape of a Guerrilla Radio on CFUV. And that is a conversation I had with George Monbiot. And George, his name is spelled Monbiot. If you go to his website, monbiot.com, Monbiot.com, yeah, he's a really interesting guy, and he's covered a lot of ground, a lot of different things. But one of the interesting things to me is that we recorded this interview just 4 days after the invasion of Iraq, this last invasion of Iraq. And so, you know, some of the things he's saying here, I mean, I forgot about them, some of them myself, you know, the oil bourse and some of the other, just, you know, the fact that, that you know, the United States was more intent on controlling the flow of oil, not necessarily owning it, you know, which was something that, you know, other people came up with later. But George is definitely ahead of the curve on that. Well, that's all the time I got for today. So I'm going to play myself out with a bit of Jeremy Fisher, because he's kind of one of those environmental dudes, you know, very good guy and a good musician. And tell you that you can stick around, because Arnold's coming up with Rhythm and Ink to jazz you into the little less soggy evening than it was when I came out to the university earlier today. Thanks, of course, go out to Rand and Seibold, and his book is, again, Green Night, Black Night, and it's like, you know, green energy and then black, like oil and stuff. But yeah, check him out at turbinemarketing.com. And maybe Janine will be here next week. I don't know. But that's all I got for you this time.
I don't want to go, so I think it'll hurt to see a little morning light. together and talk about the weather.